Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Ta In, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking about Kristen Hong's new book, A Violent Peace, Race, U.S. Militarism, and Cultures of Democratization in Cold War Asia and Pacific. Kristen Hong is Associate Professor of University of California, Santa Cruz. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Daim, thank you so much for inviting me to be in conversation with you.
It's our pleasure to have you. Kristen, I wonder if we can begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I mean, my professional biography is just what you mentioned. I'm at UC Santa Cruz. I also serve as the director of the program in Critical Race and Ethnic Studies. I am the co-director and co-founder of a new Center for Racial Justice at UC Santa Cruz, along with Neda Atanasoski. And also, along with Neda Atanasoski, I co-edit, the Journal of Critical Ethnic Studies. I'll say a little bit more. I'm also involved on the side with an organization called the Korea Policy Institute. And I've had a long association with this institute. It's a post 9/11 formation, and it's basically a public educational and research organization that has ties to grassroots organizations both within the United States as well as in South Korea. And one of the things that we have been doing is trying to promote a clear picture of people's interests in peace and in labor justice with regard to U.S. policy toward Korea. Recently, we have also sponsored and been involved in a teaching initiative to end the Korean War, and I'm happy to speak about this later. So one of the things that I do, not just on the side, I should say, but something that actually actively informs my research and even my orientation toward the university is my anti-war activism.
Yeah, that sounds really relevant and very important. And also, it sounds like you have a lot on your plate. So thank you so much again for being on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah. How did you come to write your book? I mean, you talk about it with your anti-war activism, but then, yeah, we would love to know more about what came as your inspiration for the book.
My inspiration for this book came from my first visit to South Korea in the 1990s. So I first visited South Korea in the mid-1990s, and this was an eye-opening experience for me. It this is my first time that I had, it was the first time that I had seen people's democracy, participatory democracy in action. You know, democracy is a term that is much bandied about, but this was a time in which there were protests on a regular basis in a kind of four college area within Seoul. And I, you know, it was so striking to me to see South Korean youth taking to the streets, getting tear gassed. And of course, we're in a very different historical moment in the United States in which this too has become a sort of routine experience for people who are participating in Black Lives Matter protests. Of course, the 1960s, you saw this as well in the United States. But this is something that was actively happening in South Korea when I first visited. It was also the case that this was my first time visiting areas within South Korea that scholars refer to as camp towns in English. And seeing the impact and the imprint of the U.S. military and having no easy explanatory vocabulary for this kind of military stranglehold over South Korea. And instead, there being films, for example, in the early 1990s, there was a film called Falling Down that was a big Hollywood blockbuster film. And it featured a scene of the, you know, sort of a sort of anti-hero, the protagonist, a white man who was working for the military-industrial complex within the Los Angeles area, who gets laid off as the Cold War is starting to thaw, and then finds himself going to a Korean immigrant-owned mom-and-pop store in, you know, the South Los Angeles area. And going in there, there's a conversation that he has with the Korean immigrant store owner. And he basically, I mean, you could see a lot of tropes in this film that cast forward to our present Trump slash MAGA moment. And it's basically a disgruntled white man who feels the unseating of U.S., you know, sort of global dominance and also white supremacy very acutely. And so he goes into this store and has an altercation with the store owner. And what he says to the Korean store owner is, "Do you know how much my country has done for your country?" And so there's this notion that Koreans are indebted to the United States. And, you know, what I began to see when I was in South Korea and what I subsequently really discovered and, you know, through the course of my research in graduate school was exactly how inverted that narrative is. The United States, in the wake of World War II, had a war economy. Basically, World War II was the occasion for the United States to transform itself into a total war state. What that basically meant was that there was no clear distinction between a kind of front line over there and a domestic arena over here. Industries that had previously been directed to producing tractors and automobiles and nails, you know, that you would hammer into a wall, all of a sudden were making tanks, were making bullets, were making munitions. And so the United States fundamentally transformed into a total war economy. That had a lot of repercussions domestically as well, which I can talk about later. But suffice it to say that in the wake of U.S. victory in World War II, in the two principal theaters of war, in the European theater and in the Pacific theater. The United States emerged maybe victorious, but it had an economic problem on its hand. It was structured as a war economy. And so, you know, even if you look at documents from around the time that the Cold War was starting to dawn, and with the start of the U.S. Interventionist war in Korea, generals and politicians were very, very point blank in stating that there had to be a Korea somewhere in the world. There had to be, and they also stated Korea came along and saved us. So in other words, what was it that Korea did? Well, Korea served as the occasion for the United States to rehabilitate its war economy, even though a lot of this is opaque to Americans who regard the Korean War as a forgotten war. The fact of the matter is that Korea and that interventionist war, which is not over to this day, served as the occasion for the restructuration of U.S. power on the global stage. It transformed this economy into a permanent war economy. Permanent, a kind of militarized economy requires permanent war around the world. It also served as the occasion and the rationale for the expansion of what Chalmers Johnson referred to as the U.S. Empire of Bases. It served as an occasion for the consolidation of the national security complex. It fortified and expanded and also served as the foundation for the military industrial complex. These are all infrastructural legacies that we live with to this day that occurred as a result of a place that most American GIs at the dawning point of the Cold War had no idea where to locate on a global map. And so this is just to say that Korea, although out of sight and out of mind, although seemingly peripheral, although viewed as, you know, just an ally today, South Korea, and then the enemy being, you know, North Korea, even though there's very little of this weighs on the American, you know, sort of consciousness. The fact of the matter is that U.S. interventionist action and massive destruction in Korea really enabled U.S. dominance on the world stage in the wake of World War II.
That's really, I think it's really illuminating because if I may share my personal story as well, I remember when I was very young, I visited the States with my dad, who's like very anti-American. And then I remember I actually ran across this like soldier, I think GI soldier. And then I was basically telling her about how, you know, the US basically messed Korea up. And then she told me, well, actually we helped Korea to become a democratic country. What you were saying about falling down reminds me of my personal experiences as well about it. And then I was educated in Canada. I grew up in Canada. And I also remember, in Canadian history classes in high school, we would learn about the good war, right? And I think that's why I really appreciated how you deconstructed this idea of good war. And I was also very fascinated by how you discussed race and how a lot of people believe that in a way World War II like contributed to a civil rights movement and for, you know, desegregation. And you also mentioned in chapter one about how desegregation happened in Korean in Korean military bases. But then at the same time, you talk about how in a way, this also this kind of erased the fact that based on racial hierarchy, these violence is being enacted upon racialized bodies. So I wonder if you can talk more about how I think you call it convergence of biopolitics and geopolitics in your book, because I was very interested in how you were talking about the, you know, supposed blurring of color line actually increasing the efficiency of the war's necropolitical target.
Yeah. You know, thank you also for that very elegant synoptic account of the theoretical and historical framework of my book. And I wanted to say too, you know, one thing that I think so many of us realize who have studied the history of U.S.-Korea relations closely, it's not the case that democracy flourished in South Korea because of U.S. intervention. It's precisely despite U.S. intervention. And, you know, a figure who is much loved, like Jimmy Carter, you know, who had a very sort of humanitarian post-presidency and who received, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, the thing that sullies his record is precisely the stance that his administration took on Gwangju. You know, so if you look at the history of U.S. intervention on the Korean Peninsula, it isn't as though so-called democracy promotion leads to the flourishing of democracy. Democracy promotion is precisely predicated upon the United States enfolding its sub-imperial allies into its own war posture, and it's predicated upon war. And so back to the point that you were raising about the investment that my book has in rethinking a kind of post-war account of the liberalization of U.S. race relations. What I look at is how the dynamic of desegregation or racial integration actually has its origins not in Brown versus Board of Education, but actually in U.S. desegregation. You know, and this is a sort of Truman basically authorizing this by executive order, but desegregation not happening in earnest until the U.S. war in Korea. And so, you know, basically thinking about that as a very, very vexed origin for an account of racial liberalism. In 2013, then President Barack Obama stood at the, you know, in front of the Korean War Memorial on the National Mall. And there were a series of dignitaries from Park Geun-hye's government seated in front of him, as well as Korean War veterans. And what he stated was that the Korean War was a victory. You know, even though people typically don't say that, and no historian would ever agree with that statement, he nonetheless stated that. And he said that the reason was, and he was, you know, in front of this memorial that has, if you look at the National Park Service account of the Korean War Memorial, you realize that X number of those 7-foot steel statues are Asian American, X number are African American, X number are Chicano or Latino, X number are American Indian, X number are white, you know. So it's basically supposed to be a kind of multicultural rendering of soldiers on the battlefield. And, you know, he said that if Black, white, Asian, Latino, American Indian soldiers could fight shoulder to shoulder over there, surely they could do the same over here. So he was basically stating that the service of Korean War veterans led to the fluorescence of the civil rights movement, you know, basically arguing a kind of militarized multicultural beginnings to the civil rights movement. And so in my book, what I'm interested in looking at is how at the same time that the United States, with an eye to the efficiency of its war machine, actually integrates, racially integrates its military ranks, it also does something very interesting, which is it expands with, it incorporates other kinds of sub-imperial allies also into its military. And so, you know, we can think in the post 9/11 era when George W. Bush used the term coalition of the willing. And you can think through to an earlier historical moment, the Vietnam War era moment when Lyndon B. Johnson used a term like more flags, right? And so, and then you can think about how the Korean War, the sort of strategic use of the United Nations as a kind of banner to be able to argue multilateral, multinational, and multiracial participation in U.S. wars of intervention. And to think about that in conjunction with military desegregation, and to understand that at the same time that the idea of indistinction, of the blurring of the color line, is held up as a kind of liberal principle, right, of a kind of post-racial society. At the same time that that's happening, it's also the case that that principle of indistinction is fortifying U.S. military ranks, and it's operative as well in the notion of the twinned notion of the war target, where there's an indistinction of man, woman, child, communist, non-communist, you know, where there is a kind of indistinction that's operative there, as well as what we see happening domestically, which is a kind of indistinction that is happening in the notion of the racial profile, right? And so that conflation of geopolitics and biopolitics, which you mentioned, really occurs in the notion of the target and the profile, which conflates racialized humanity with racialized terrain. And so to me, this is where I start to explore one of the key concepts of my book project, which was thinking about the fascism of U.S. war power, not the liberalism, but the fascism.
Yeah. And this reminds me of how in chapter one, you analyze Ralph Ellison's writing to show how policing of security really shows that fascism exists under the pretense or like the disguise of U.S. democracy, as well as in chapter three, like I found this to be so fascinating. You talk about Mine Okubo, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but then how she's like really celebrated for her depiction of incarcerated Japanese Americans, but then her role in securitization is really under examined. And you look at making of citizen subject and how Japanese American and Japanese are conflated, therefore reintegrating Japan as like somehow like the receiver of, you know, U.S. democracy, when actually there is like war violence that is happening. I found it really fascinating how supposedly American subject and inclusion only come at the expense of, erasure or like elimination of racialized others, because they're conflated at the same time. It was a really wonderful analysis. And I wonder whether you can talk more about, you know, how you analyze, you know, creative literary writing as well as photographs, and, in academia, writings has always been like more privileged, but what were your thought processes and analyzing these different things, how you came across them, and how you were able to formulate your ideas through these archives?
Yeah, you know, I mean, thank you again for engaging so closely with my work. You know, one of the things that I found so striking in the course of doing my research was how life opportunity for racialized subjects, subjects who were racially indistinguishable in many cases from the enemy, you know, how life opportunity took the form of securitization, and how securitization is a form of racialization. It is a form of sifting between those that can be killed and those that can be allowed to live. But the conditions for being allowed to live, and you can see this in my chapter on the Korean War mascot, is precisely to don a kind of second skin in the form of the U.S. military uniform, right? And so I was interested some of Ralph Ellison's unknown writing. You know, he is so celebrated for having written Invisible Man. This is held out to be his magnum opus. Yet he states himself in a 1981 preface to that book, which was published circa the Korean War, you know, hot fighting era. He states in a later preface to that book that the inception for Invisible Man was a war novel in which a black airman was, taken captive within the European theater and incarcerated in a Nazi POW camp. And the Nazi POW camp isn't just sort of safely fascism over there. Instead, during the war period, Ellison was very much a black radical. And what he and other black radicals, as well as, black mainstream newspapers like the Pittsburgh Courier, what they understood all too well was that the black soldier fighting in a Jim Crow army wasn't just fighting racism and fascism over there, i.e. the Nazis, but fighting racism and fascism over here, i.e. the United States. And the term that he had, and of course, so this is just to say that his account of a black pilot held captive in a Nazi POW camp was an allegory for a sort of invisible war at home. So like there's this invisible war, and he speaks about this. He says that from the betrayal of radical reconstruction up until the time that he's writing during the Korean War, that there has been this invisible war that has occurred, this sort of war that has occurred against black people within the United States. And he refers to this as the kind of conundrum as democracy within the teeth of fascism. And so this became a very kind of evocative and thought-provoking way of understanding the kind of perverse sort of coding of militarized life possibility, of collusive life possibility as a form of democracy. And you could see throughout this book that the military uniform, the war front, atomic bomb blasted landscapes, all of this, the U.S. concentration camp, all of these kinds of militarized arenas that are fundamentally shot through by U.S. war power become the site of a kind of constrained democratic, quote-unquote, possibility for racial subjects. And so this is, this is a kind of through line for the book as a whole. You mentioned my use of photographs. And one thing that I have been doing as a kind of perverse hobby over the past almost two decades is that I have been collecting GI photographs and photo albums of the U.S. war front, principally in Korea, but also in other areas. And, it's really hard to know how to approach these kinds of materials. When you think about, I don't want to overgeneralize here, but at least speaking for my own family, there are members of my family who lived through profound, life-altering, world-deforming, destroying, and reshaping U.S. war violence. And yet we don't have a documentary record of any of that. And by contrast, U.S. GIs often had small Kodak cameras. And in fact, this war comics artist named Bill Hume, he stated that the camera, the portable camera, was a part of the GI's uniform. It was so ubiquitous that so many of them had it. So they were, in that way, sort of individual documentarians. And you didn't even need to have embedded journalists in terms of the sort of skewed perspective that they had in terms of what they documented. But I was very interested in thinking about this documentary trove that stood in such stark contrast to the sort of document poor personal archive of my own family. And through the course of collecting these albums and these photos, I saw again and again, Koreans would pop up, in these photographs. And in many cases, they would pop up as houseboys or as mascots. And here I was really interested not just in the donning of the U.S. military uniform in miniature, like miniature scaled sizes, these mascots wearing these uniforms, but I was also interested to see the very sort of uncomfortable relationality between, or at least uncomfortable for me, seeing the kind of relationality between mascots and members of these military, these American military units. And to realize that, as Sharon Holland says, that racism fundamentally structures the erotic. And to see this at play in a lot of these photographs as well. But also trying to think about what kind of reading practice should we have toward these kinds of documents.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. That just raised so many important issues from, in a way, the limitation of scholarship, because the archive that's most visible is also the one that is created by power in this position, GI soldiers, while the common people's lives are undocumented and their silences in scholarship, in a way, is invalidated, especially considering how, we privilege in scholarship, like writing, and then, photos are now used more, but then, what happens when people don't have documentation. And I think you talk about how
before you go on, could I just interject and say one thing? This goes to your own work that you had previously done before you came to your doctoral studies at UCLA, and I know that what you looked at was you looked at the experience of women villagers during the hot fighting period of the Korean War, which, as you and I and so many other Koreans understand, is a war that has never been concluded with a peace agreement of any kind. And, you know, some years ago, I had the opportunity, I think it was back in 2011, I had the opportunity to interview one of the standing commissioners of the South Korean Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Kim Dong-chun. And I asked him about the centrality of sexual violence during the hot fighting period, you know, the battle phase of the Korean War, and the degree to which the TRCK focused on that. And he said that that was an oversight of the TRCK. And it was really interesting to talk to Charlie Hanley, who was one of the three AP reporters, along with Martha Mendoza, and also, the New York Times reporter, Choi Sang-hoon. It was really interesting to talk to him about his book, The Bridge Over Nogonri, you know, and to ask him about this. And, you know, one of the, he interviewed someone who was an adult, who was probably at that time older, middle age, but was a child during the time of that atrocity. And this child spoke about peering through the windows of one of the homes in the village and seeing one of the women villagers being raped by US GIs. And, you know, what was interesting to the AP team, I mean, aside from being horrified by this tale, was that they said, well, we've interviewed everyone. And, you know, this story has never come up. And what the Korean man who had been a boy said was, well, you have spoken to this woman, you know, but she hasn't shared her story. And so realizing that there are lots of gaps and lots of structuring omissions, and that when those gaps and omissions then get reproduced in scholarly accounts, how much is left out of our understanding of the biopolitical nature of war violence. And as you and I also know, it's also been a very interesting thing to realize that, you know, there's this sort of distinction made between the so-called comfort woman and then the sort of camp town prostitute. And the distinction is not just that one was under Japanese imperial rule and the other one was under sort of U.S., you know, sort of, you know, what you could also call U.S. imperial, you know, sort of control. And, but it's that the distinction is one of supposed voluntary, the voluntary nature of the camp town prostitute, that she, you know, may have been poor and had a series of sort of structural circumstances militating against her abundance or variety of life choices, yet she chose this life path. So that's been the sort of received narrative. But, you know, what happened was in recent years, the legal team for camp town prostitutes who have been waging a battle in the South Korean courts about the human rights violation that the South Korean government perpetrated in jointly administering with the United States the entire camp town prostitution system, that legal team, they found in the Library of Congress a document that indicated the South Korean government referred to these camp town prostitutes in their earliest manifestation as wianbu. They use the same term as comfort woman. And so, you know, there are definitely differences within the systems. There are historical distinctions to be made, but there's a lot of structural similarity that really does need to be discussed more fully.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it, reminds me of Catherine Moon's work as well, about Kijichon on Camptown, and how she basically says that Camptown is a corporation. It's a corporation that is like created by the U.S. and also South Korea for the benefit, and then the idea of choice as well. You obviously like it's like not a. I guess the idea of agency and choice is so tricky in a way, because within the structure, within the economic and like structure and pressure, some people might have said they had a choice, but at the same time, do you really in that structure? I think that's a very important point. And yeah, I think to go back about the Korean War, one of the reason why I jumped from, looking at women's experiences in the villages to domestic workers is because a lot of women that I interviewed talk about becoming domestic worker. They were just so ubiquitous because of the economic situation at the time, because of the poverty and how they were, at the danger of, like sexual assault from the employer. So it's like,
I think that connection is very interesting to think about, to think about militarized prostitution and then to think about domestic labor and to realize too that, sort of militarized sexual labor and as well as like the labor of mascots, the labor of houseboys, the labor of colonial conscripts, whether or not, that's too dated of a term to apply to U.S. military empire, but to understand that all of these different racialized figures that are enfolded into the U.S. war machine play a reproductive function relative to that war machine. Their labor is essential to the reproduction of U.S. militarism. And to understand that that labor has often been racialized colonial labor.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess the complicity of South Korea as well and the South Korean men, I think is also such an important part of this discussion, because I guess, White Supremacy Project, it is a project that is carried on by different actors in history. And as much as the U.S. military is to be held responsible, I think it's definitely important to think about. But then, how about the domestic violences, that is happening? The South Korean government and the patriarchal system, it also contributes to that as well, to that like power dynamic. Yeah,
I think that's an interesting point. In the book, I look at how, people who are, scholars of, Asian area studies scholars who are looking at Japan during the occupation period write about a moment that's referred to as reverse course. So if at first, when, MacArthur lands at Atsugi Airfield and, what have you, the communists, are released from Japanese prisons, right? If they're released, then the reverse course, which signals a shift that has to do with the dawning Cold War order, sees these people precisely who were released being rounded up again and incarcerated. And so that reverse course plays out on a larger regional scale in terms of U.S. anti-communist, anti-communist counterinsurgencies throughout the region. And so you see basically what happens all throughout the region, and I focus on the Philippines, is basically those figures that collaborated with Japan, far from being prosecuted for that collusion, instead are oftentimes lifted to positions of executive authority within the nation. you know, and that's true in South Korea, that's true in any number of places throughout Asia and the Pacific, that those who collaborated are then lifted into positions of power and rehabilitated under a dawning Pax Americana anti-communist order. And you see the impact of that rehabilitation. It saturates the societies, the post-war societies of different locations, but the entanglement is sub-imperial in nature. And, you know, there are scholars and activists who have said, for example, with regard to Ferdinand Marcos, that Washington supplied the bullets and Marcos held the gun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, that definitely reminds me of, you know, your chapter in chapter 5 about U.S. counterinsurgency actually eroding decolonization movement and participatory democracy that you also spoke of earlier. And then I guess you analyze Carlos Bulosan's work in chapter 5 about how it's, in a way, it's like an effort to counter the erasure and also assert the last word about revolutionary struggle. And yeah, it's like connection to Korea and decolonization is also so interesting as well. This, I guess, like label of communism. And in my own research too, I realized that, you know, a lot of villagers, you know, didn't identify themselves as communists, but then at the same time, you know, like anything that was seen as like threatening would have to be immediately eliminated. And then, yeah, I think it goes back to, you know, your book's point about target as well, and how it's like very widespread reach. Yeah.
I mean, I was interested in thinking through a kind of twinned trajectory, and it's not even, these are not parallel tracks, these are interoperable tracks, but basically the United States during World War II launched an investigation of, you know, basically spies and, you know, the fear of domestic spies. So if you have if the war front and the domestic front are blurred and there's no distinction between one and the other, then that means that your enemies could be right there at your back door. And so from the perspective of the national security state, you know, the threats to subversion, including racial disaffection during a time that the sort of the country is Jim Crow. These are all viewed like, you know, if you are disaffected because you are, you know, victimized by white supremacy, then you're potentially an enemy of the state. You know, I mean, and, you know, basically what happens during this time is that the federal government launches through the FBI a survey called Racial Conditions in the United States, or RACON. And RACON basically aims to rout out subversion in what are viewed to be communist circles, what are viewed to be black civil rights circles, what are viewed to be principally Japanese, but other Asian sort of organizing spaces in the United States. And, you know, in my book, I suggest that there is a connection between RACON and what comes as COINTELPRO. You know, so COINTELPRO being really a war against people domestically. And then to also realize that the United States waged wars of racial counterintelligence, you know, the Korean War, the United States uses racial counterintelligence. It does during the Vietnam War. It does in its counterinsurgencies in Asia throughout the Cold War period. You know, the United States draws up whitelists, gray lists, black lists. That all presupposes a kind of quote unquote like native informant. It requires the native informant. And so all of this is based upon structures of collusion.
And this is making me think about the academia as well, and then the creation of East Asian studies. I mean, not just East Asian studies, but area studies in the first place to serve a military industrial complex.
Yes, I mean, I think that, you know, it's such an interesting point. You know, this is even when you think about Asian area studies as a distinctively Cold War formation, even if it has origins within Orientalism, you know, this is a subsidized field. The government subsidizes this actively throughout the Cold War. So much money goes to it. Funding goes to this. And you realize that the figure of the Native informant also looms within Asian area studies, and, you know, but in sort of curious ways. So, you know, this is something that Naoki Sakai speaks about in his own work. He says that, you know, academia is sort of bifurcated in its structure of how it understands differential forms of humanity. And you can understand these as related along a kind of racial hierarchy, or placed differently on a racial hierarchy. And he says that there's anthropos. And you, of course, can understand that as anthropology, ethnic studies, etc., but also area studies. You know, anthropos is that subject who is studied. It's the object to be studied, maybe not a subject, the object to be studied. Versus humanitas. And humanitas is the subject that knows. And so you could see both forms of subjectivity racially coded operative in a field like Asian area studies. And you could also see it, you know, like Asian area studies. I mentioned Chalmers Johnson before. Chalmers Johnson was a figure who started off in a kind of collusion along intelligence lines, working for the CIA as a Japanist, and then has a kind of an awakening in Okinawa in the 1990s when, you know, there's a series of rapes that occur, and realizes, you know, becomes a sort of anti-imperialist scholar. And, you know, but that speaks also to the kind of nature of collusion along intelligence lines with the national security state. And it's precisely against that collusion that a field like critical Asian studies asserts its difference. It says we realize our complicity, the complicity of our field to the U.S. war machine, to a kind of posture of exploitation of the peoples of Asia, and we declare our critique of that kind of collusion. But you know, I think that that's also where it's important to realize that ethnic studies as a field, although it forms at the same time as critical Asian studies, and although both fields form out of a critique of U.S. war violence in Vietnam and the ways in which academically sourced knowledges are used to fortify the U.S. war machine. It's the case that those fields also are quite different. And I think that it's very interesting that ethnic studies is a field that in its origins, I'm not talking about its institutionalized formation, but in its political origins was aimed at the liberation of people, and to understand that as being a very sort of crucial distinction between area studies as a field formation and ethnic studies as a field formation.
Thank you so much for this really like wonderful like contribution, and like I think like for me especially who wants to be in this field, that like I really I just like I don't know how to express my appreciation of like what you're doing, and like especially like talking about you know, how the social movement in a way was a genesis of the field, and like trying to blur social movement in academia. But I've taken up a lot of your time, so I wanted to ask the final question of NBN, and that is, what are you currently working on?
So, Diane, thank you so much for your conversation today and for reaching out to me. I'm happy to speak about my current work. The work that I have been involved in is I'm part of a collective, a teaching initiative collective. It's the Ending the Korean War Collective, and we had a victory earlier this year. The Association for Asian American Studies passed our resolution calling for a decolonizing end to the Korean War. Some of us who are part of this collective also were part of something called the Alliance of Scholars Concerned About Korea, and we had over a decade ago launched a three-year teaching initiative calling for a decolonizing end to the Korean War. We are reanimating that along somewhat different lines, critically different lines this time. And what we are working on as a collective is a public syllabus so that people who are activists, people who are working on, you know, aspects of Korea, who are scholars, they could teach this. They can teach this in activist settings, in academic settings. So we're working on a public syllabus project, and we're also working on other aspects of the teaching initiative. The other thing that I have in the wings, I've published a great deal on North Korea, and that was scholarship that didn't come from any training in Asian studies, but came from my, really the inception of it was my activist work, working to end the Korean War, And so I have another book. I have several articles already completed that have been published in various journals, Critical Asian Studies, Positions, and other places on North Korea and the Korean War. And that is the subject of my second book project. And there too, I will look at the kind of political work of Black radical organizations like the Civil Rights Congress that had an incredibly penetrating critique of what was, you know, sort of pejoratively called U.S. police action in Korea. But the Civil Rights Congress understood that so-called police action in Korea in conjunction with a rising police state and police brutality domestically. And so part of my book will look at that particular convergence.
Wow, this sounds amazing. And I would love to read your articles on North Korea. Like it's and then I just love how you're tying in, you know, the works of a Black civil rights activist and really like blurring the disciplinary boundaries as well. But then thank you so much for being in this podcast. I learned a lot and it was really amazing to talk to you.
It was such a pleasure. Let's definitely stay in touch, Diane.
Yeah, let's definitely stay in touch. Thank you.